Hey everybody, welcome to Beers with Chad. I'm your host, Chad Wesley Smith, and this is a podcast about the stuff I like. So I wanted to start off today talking about my flag football team, the Costa Mesa first and second grade 49ers. So I'm coaching a team with my nephew, my best friend of 20 years, Paul, his two sons who are, you know, I'm Uncle Chad to them, two, my buddy Colby, his son, Dennis's son, you know, if you're getting the picture, my nephew and most of my friends' sons. So these our league is first and second grade, but our team is actually first grade and two kindergartners. So all 6 and 7 year old boys. And this is my first time actually coaching any youth sports. You know, I've studied a lot about long-term athletic development. I've, you know, watched my nephew and my nieces play and you know, as I do, judged it with a critical eye. So this is my first real experience getting to do that, and it's been a lot of fun so far. And we won our first game last Friday night, so I really enjoyed that. You know, it was critical that we got to be the 49ers, and not just because that's my favorite team, but this is also all part of a concerted effort to win over my best friend Paul, his sons Cal and Wes, win them over to 49ers fandom. So Paul grew up outside of Dallas, Texas, and naturally is a diehard Cowboys fan. But two seasons ago, Paul and I were going to the divisional round playoff game, Cowboys at 49ers. And I asked him on the way up there, I said, well, who are the boys rooting for? And his older son, Cal, you know, who would have been like 6 at the time, said to him, well, you know, I want the Cowboys, but it's okay if the 49ers win too, because that's Uncle Chad's favorite team and that's Lucas's favorite team, one of his other friends who's also on the team. And with that moment, I saw that there was an opening, an opportunity to bring these two young football fans over from the dark side of Cowboy fandom into the light of 49ers fandom. And in doing so, troll the hell out of my best friend. And, you know, who can pass up a time like that? So, you know, I got my buddy Dustin, the 49ers strength coach, on board with this idea. Christian McCaffrey signed autographed a ball for them, you know, to Cal and Wes, go 49ers, Christian McCaffrey. And then I'm surrounding him with, you know, more easily impressionable, less, you know, tight allegiance fan allied kids like Ollie, like Jackson, these other boys on the team. So it was several weeks ago, you know, probably almost 2 months ago, now that I had my first contact with the guy who runs the league. It's Matt Leinart Flag Football, and it's his dad, you know, Bob is in charge of running the league. So I get a call one day from Bob, and he's Coach Smith. You know, what team do you guys want to be? And I tell him the 49ers. He checks his list and says, yeah, you got it. All good to go. Fast forward a couple weeks from there, getting closer to the start of the season. And while I'm on about the 9th hole at Pebble Beach, I get a frantic text message from one of the moms. Have you checked your email? And I do then check my email and see that they were giving us the Raiders, you know. So not the 49ers, but the Raiders. And like Marissa is going to be excited about that because of obvious reasons. So I email back and I say, you know, mind you, I'm a couple pops in here on the course, but and say, let me know what donation I need to make to ensure that we're the 49ers, or if the other team who's coach, you know, the coach of whatever team got the 49ers, tell them that, you know, let's meet on the 50-yard line and we'll wrestle for it. I don't know if the guys thought that those were funny. I did email them later as a little bit more serious, like, hey, I already bought, you know, gloves for all these kids and you know, I do this consulting work for the 49ers. So like, I acknowledge that this is too important to me, a grown man, that my group of 7-year-old boys gets to be the 49ers for my own enjoyment, but please let them be the 49ers. And they acquiesced to my demands. So we go out, win our first game 25-6. Pretty dominant performance. Proud of my boys because we're running, you know, I say we're not calling plays, we're running an offense. And for these little 7-year-old guys to get down, you know, that they're running motion and, you know, there's a fake here and then we're hitting a counter coming back. You know, so we're running jet sweeps with counter coming back off of it, jet sweep with boot action off of that, and they executed pretty well. So, you know, very, very proud of their performance, and I'll be keeping you updated as we go throughout this year. You know, a couple of other things in it. So we go out to pizza after the game, and all the parents are pumped, and, you know, they find that I'm probably a little bit more serious about this, you know, and I'm trying not to be serious in the way I'm not hard on the kids. I feel very uncomfortable yelling at little kids, especially because I don't have kids. So I got to make sure that after this season is done, you know, I'm still Uncle Chad and they're not freaked out. You know, we're not 10 years down the road at their high school graduation and I go to give, you know, my real nephew or fake nephews a hug and they're like wincing, like, I'm sorry, Coach Smith, I'm sorry. You know, I don't want that. So I'm very well prepared for these practices and take it very seriously in that regard. And the parents can see that and they're excited about that. And I did tell them that, you know, my main objectives are to make children on the other team cry. And I mean this, you know, mostly jokingly, but in our offense, which is only, you know, we've only played one game, give me 8 more weeks and the ideas I've got brewing up in here are, you know, we're getting wild with this offense. I'm like a lawless Mike Leach over here. But my goal is to make children on the other team cry. And, you know, while they're on their way home from the game, after they've been hit with, you know, these subtle ball fakes and magician-like misdirections, for them to just be, but Dad, I thought that kid had the ball, and then it was the guy that can't go the other way had the ball. I didn't understand. Yes, I want that. If you're an opponent watching this, my goal is to make your child cry. Other goal, for the other coaches on the other teams to get so frustrated by how badly we're dominating them that, you know, they want to fight, but then they look over and they're like, fuck, that other coach, he's fucking huge. And he already has a black eye, so he must be crazy. I think we were getting close to that in the first game because with this age of kids, I can be in the huddle with our offense and I'm standing behind them as the play is run. And then the opposing team coach, he is also standing behind our offense once we're getting ready to snap the ball. And he's, you know, he's still yelling out instructions to his defense, you know, Timmy, slide over this way, you know, Jack, get your thumb out of your ass, you know, pay attention, Billy, stop picking the grass. And I call the cadence for my team because the kids' voices can't carry enough. So I really enjoyed when he's mid-instruction that I'm seeing that we're ready to go and shifts, I go. And he's just getting more and more frustrated as we execute more and more precisely. It was also interesting that watching this, you know, we're running football plays, but it's not football, it's flag football. It's 6-on-6. There's no illegal formations. You can run like CFL style motion, like towards the line. You know, there's no rushers. It's just a 6-second clock to get a pass off. So after seeing some of the kind of weird motions that the other team was running, it did get me thinking like, I need to divorce my mind from normal football play design and, you know, start getting into like maybe take a bunch of mushrooms and, you know, see what comes to me in, you know, a Ted Lasso-esque where he invents the triangle offense for soccer, aka total football, he later finds out it is, but a similar situation to that maybe. Because even when I played high school football, and I was an offensive and defensive lineman, but I played high school football and then coached high school football for 3 years, and particularly when I was in high school, the margins of every single piece of paper in my notebook, you know, with my homework or notes or whatever on the page, the margins were just all play designs. They were stuff I, you know, picked up from watching college and professional football and just ideas that I had. And our head coach humored me enough to, you know, meet with me and take a look at them. And we actually did run some kind of similar concepts to some of that stuff And so I've always been interested by that. Sent some to my buddy Dustin, and he was impressed. You know, I told him to pass some of those ideas along to Kyle Shanahan. So we'll see if they come up. But you know, having a lot of fun with that. And then the other thing that I'm really enjoying about coaching flag football is it's given me a lot of kind of memories and connection with my dad. So I'm drinking gin and tonic today because my dad, not a big drinker, but on the rare occasions he had cocktails, he would drink a gin and tonic if we were out for like a nice dinner for Christmas or something, go to Five Crowns there in Corona del Mar, and he would drink a gin and tonic. So when I first got a fake ID, and then the first time I went to a bar, you know, I remember the bartender looking at me and asking what I wanted. And in that moment, I think probably as most people with a fake ID do at the first time that they're at a bar, you panic a little bit. And I, you know, tried not to show it on my face too much, hopefully. But the first thing that came to my mind was gin and tonic. So I ordered gin and tonic, and you know, gin maybe of all alcohols is the most acquired taste, but I did, you know, I liked them enough. I've had some good gin and tonic days. Drank a lot of gin, not even so much on the tonic side of things, on my 21st birthday. Almost fell off a boat, but that's a story for a different day. So drinking a gin and tonic for my dad, who passed away 2 years ago today. Yeah, who passed away 2 years ago today, or very early tomorrow morning. And with doing the flag football coaching, you know, I don't have kids, but this is, you know, a great opportunity for me that I feel a lot more connected to my dad doing this because he was our coach all the time. And I just have a ton of great memories around my youth sports, around sports in general, with my dad, Wes, hence the Wesley is the middle name. You know, from being a really young kid, and he was my older brother Zach's soccer coach and had been my oldest brother Adam's coaches as well for soccer and baseball and all this stuff. And Zach played club soccer, and we would travel all around. And I remember, you know, riding in the Dodge Grand Caravan to a soccer tournament in Colorado. And we've got like, you know, this is probably 1989. And we've got walkie-talkies that we can talk from our van to our friends' vans. And there's, you know, my brother's teammates, some of them riding with us. And I'm like 3 years old and they're 12, you know, and I think that they're the coolest people ever, even though they were probably torturing me a lot. And you know, so that's kind of my first memories of my dad as a coach, and he loved it. And then he coached, you know, my AYSO soccer team's t-ball. Remember the first day of t-ball were the Mets, and we, you know, get home from practice, or I'm driving home from practice, and my dad asked, "Oh, you know, how do you think it went, or how do you think the team's going to be?" Something like that. And I would watch ESPN and sports movies and all that stuff all the time. So, you know, however old you are, probably like 5 years old, I looked at him and I said, "Dad, I'm going to be the heart and soul of this team." So, you know, I've definitely been hearing a lot of coach speak and commentator speak kind of stuff. And, you know, he was just, with soccer, he was not a soccer player. I mean, you know, my dad grew up in the 40s and 50s in Ohio and Minnesota. I don't think soccer was really, really popular then. So he had never played, but, you know, he just got into soccer coaching because of my brothers and went to clinics and seminars and stuff because he wanted to do as good a job as he could of it for us. And he always coached our soccer teams and you know, would do all these footwork drills, and the practices were hard. Like, that stands out in my mind as my dad had very hard soccer practices, and we did a lot of conditioning And I remember my friends on the team before, you know, saying like, man, your dad's really hard on you. But I never felt like, you know, my dad was hard on me for sports. He was not a sports dad in that way. He wasn't, when I was coached by other people, you know, yelling at my coaches or getting on them about anything. With one exception, I do remember him and my high school defensive line coach almost getting in a fight after a game once, but my coach admitted after that my dad was right about it. So, but you know, he wasn't that kind of sports dad. He was there to support me, and you know, whether that was coaching our real teams or playing pickup basketball in our driveway, he had this hook shot he would take from the right corner of our driveway, kind of like a sky hook sort of thing, and unblockable. I could never deal with that. And, you know, always stressing to me to learn how to shoot with my left hand too was a big deal. Coaching all these soccer teams, like I said, he ran hard practices, but never in coaching or in my life, yeah, do I? Do I remember like my dad ever yelling at us or anything like that? That wasn't his personality. He was very patient. He was very patient, very principled, very caring, understanding guy. You know, and as I do this coaching, you know, I coached high school football before, coached high school track, so I've been a strength coach, but coaching little kids, it's different. You know, and coaching high school sports is different than coaching professional athletes and private strength and conditioning kind of stuff that I do. So I think much more about the character side of it and the life side of it with that stuff. So, you know, I'm trying to be as mindful as I can to, you know, live up to a standard that if my dad was there to watch, you know, his grandson being on the team, that he would be proud of how I'm doing it, that he would see that I try to be patient, they try to be caring, to nurture these kids, to be about more than the score, something my dad was always about. So we did stuff like, you know, I gave all the boys a copy of Way of the Warrior Kid. So hopefully they read that and took something from it. And yeah, I said two years ago today. But yeah, I'm very, you know, grateful for the opportunity that, you know, my friends entrust me with, you know, their sons for those 2 or so hours a week to do this. And I hope I make my dad proud with it. So today we're drinking gin and tonic, my dad's favorite drink. I don't know if I ever told him about how it was the first drink I ordered. If I did, I probably lied and said that I was of age, because he wouldn't have been happy about the fake ID part of it. But I miss you. I'm sure people, you know, of the dozens and dozens around the world listening. Some of you guys are missing yours too. So, cheers to my dad. Cheers to your dad. Welcome to Beers with Chad. All right, so over the weekend we had UFC 299. Very, very big card. Watched it over at a friend's house this upcoming weekend in the UFC fight night. We have one of the guys that I coach, Danny Silva, Santa Ana's finest, will make his UFC debut from where he got a contract off the Contender Series. So be on the lookout for him, and I'll talk about him more later this week. But in UFC 299, a couple really interesting fights. Five main ones that I want to talk about. First up in the prelims, the early prelims, Robles Despain, who was bronze medalist in Taekwondo in 2012. For Cuba, and homeboy is about 265 pounds, like an 87 inch wingspan, just a huge mammoth athlete. And in the way that some of the Cubans are, think Yoel Romero, even though this dude's like 36, still jacked, and great physique for us for a heavyweight. And he won in 18 seconds. Huge, powerful athlete, wild as fuck style. Threw a couple huge punches, then went for a head kick, fell down while throwing the head kick. And then as he got up and kind of scrambled back, as he's backing up and knocked the guy out. So I'm interested to see, he's maybe a little bit old to, make that big of a mark, but You could do that in heavyweight, and he's certainly got a pedigree. So interested to see where his career goes. No idea if he has any wrestling. No idea if he has any jiu-jitsu. Getting him against a more well-rounded fighter. I don't know anything about the guy he was fighting, but he seemed overmatched, to say the least. But will be an interesting guy to watch. Next fight that stood out to me was Mateus Gamrot and Rafael Dos Anjos. I've had the good fortune to know Hafa RDA since about 2010 when he first moved to the US. I was a strength and conditioning coach early in his UFC career. He's done a ton of training with my jiu-jitsu coach, Philippe Delamonica. They've been friends since they were little kids. And so gotten to spend a lot of time around him and definitely have a soft spot for him. He, a couple things that I hope everyone can appreciate when watching a guy like RDA, and I'm, do this more because it's a guy that I know, but he's fighting high level guys who are much younger than him. He has fought anyone and everyone that the UFC has ever wanted him to fight, whenever they want him to fight him at whatever weight class. He used to fight as a 155, where he's an interim champ, and then he went up to 170 because he just couldn't make the cut anymore. And now at nearly 40 years old, he's going back to 155 for this fight. Look at his, he's had 40, this was his 48th professional fight, and he's fought everyone. His last couple fights, Vicente Luco, Moicano, Paul Felder, Michael Chiesa, Leon Edwards, Usman, Covington, Lawler, Neil Magny, Tony Ferguson, Alvarez, Donald Cerrone twice, Anthony Pettis, Nate Diaz, Khabib, up a class, down a class, doesn't matter. RDA, class act, super hard worker. He was in great shape. He's been back training mostly in Brazil. Lost on the decision, but he really had a couple moments in the first round where it seemed like he was going to finish Gamrot, and sort of after this one knockdown, just rushed in a bit too much and ended up, kind of losing the position and Gamrot catching a single leg on him in what was a great opportunity for him to finish. But a special nod to RDA, always going to be a fan of him. Michael Venom Page, coming over from Bellator in his first fight. A showman, definitely, with the Undertaker entrance. Not my personal style of guy, but, it's the fight. It's show business, not just the fight. So he does have a very, very creative style, though. A great striker, a great athlete, certainly. And, he put on a bit of a clinic there against Kevin Holland. To be fair, though, I was distracted for a lot of the fight as we're watching at my buddy Dennis's house, and several members of the mini 49ers were in attendance. So we had, 3 7-year-olds, a 6-year-old boy, a 3-year-old boy trying to get in the mix, and the 10-year-old big sister, who pretty much had their own fight club going on while we were watching. They have the Hulk gloves, one Hulk glove each, and are going at it in these one-handed boxing matches. And a lot of it was happening during that match, so I didn't get to put the critical analytical eye on it that I might have normally. But, following up with it after the fact, MVP, I'm interested to see who he gets. I saw some people talking about Khamzat for him. That's going to be a really tough matchup for him. I don't think he's got the wrestling, defensive wrestling skills to deal with that. Great win for Dustin Poirier. A very exciting fight. Going into that, I would have thought, maybe Poirier's a little past his prime. This is going to be tough for him, but, he did great. He's a tough dude. He's another guy who's fought everyone. So hopefully he gets, a good, interesting matchup and can get a good payday coming up. And then the main event, Sugar Sean O'Malley versus Chito Vera. Chito's a local guy here. My guy Danny spars with him pretty much every week. Our house was definitely rooting for Chito. I don't like Sean O'Malley. He seems like a douchebag. 3 years ago, I was at Cowboys at Rams at SoFi. SoFi had just opened, and we're sitting in these VIP seats, no big deal. And it has a private bar underneath the stands. And at some point, I'm down there, and I kind of look over at the bar. The guy next to me, I was like, this guy's got weird fucking hair. Huh. He really looks like that Sean O'Malley guy. But he's wearing a shirt with Sugar Sean O'Malley on it. That doesn't seem like... What a douchey move. So that's kind of my impression of Sean O'Malley. More of a character than he is maybe a great fighter, but, he's an excellent, excellent striker. Very creative, interesting timing that he uses, and he was a lot better than Chito Vera. Chito Vera is the fifth-ranked fighter in that division. He shouldn't be fighting for a title. He's a good fighter, but fifth rank doesn't earn you title, and that's part of my problem with Sean O'Malley, is that because the UFC sees him as this, star in the making or current star, they're giving him a little bit of special treatment. And hopefully after this fight, that special treatment ends and he takes the fight that, with the most deserving guy, Merab Dalashvili, who is unbelievable. When Merab fought Peter Yan and had 49 takedown attempts in 5 rounds and looked like he was ready for 49 more, I cannot wait to see Merab do that to Sean O'Malley, because O'Malley is going to be nowhere near the strength to deal with that, nowhere near the defensive wrestling to deal with that, with Merab's just unbelievable pace and intensity. So I'm looking forward to Merab dismantling Sean O'Malley, who looks like a clown and acts like a clown, and I don't know. Maybe, you know, he's probably big on TikTok with the broccoli heads. You know, that's a me, an old man, shaking my fist at the cloud. Today's episode of Beers with Chad is brought to you by the Juggernaut AI app. If you want the smartest program for you, fully customized, adapts to your feedback, grows as you grow as a lifter, visit juggernautai.app and use code BEERS to save on your monthly subscription. All right, so I want to talk about some NFL free agency as well. First up, the 49ers free agent stuff. Not loving it so far, Eric Armstead likely gone, you know, didn't want to take a pay cut, understandable. I'm not sure how big that pay cut they wanted is, but hasn't signed anywhere else yet. So we'll see what ends up happening, you know, if he finds that the grass is greener somewhere else or not. Javon Kinlaw gone. Cleveland Farrell is gone. Chase Young probably gone. Farrell, I would have liked to see them re-sign. Kinlaw, I knew was probably on the way out. So guys that they brought in, Leonard Floyd was a stud with the Rams, really solid with the Bills. He's a twitchy, bendy, elastic edge defender who you'd think is just a great pass rusher. He gives pass rush specialist vibes and is good for like 10 sacks a year, but also a very highly graded run defender. That's why I was more high on them keeping Cleveland Farrell rather than Chase Young or Randy Gregory. Randy Gregory also going to be gone. But Leonard Floyd, I think, is a good addition. $10 million a year, not a bad contract. Also got from the Panthers, Yetur Gross-Matos. I know with him, they're liking the flexibility that he can play inside some as well as outside. Eric Armstead offered some of that same flexibility. This is obviously going to be on a much lower price tag. And then they got Jordan Elliott from the Browns, who's pretty highly graded run defender. The 49ers were not very good against the run this year, despite their D-line, you know, room talent and the great linebackers. But I do think a good bit of that was scheme. We'll see how much the new DC, Sorensen, can sort that out with this new personnel. But right now, you know, a day and a half into free agency, the 49ers defensive line room is feeling a little thin. Then the juice, you know, possible Kyle Juszczyk restructure, pay cut. We'll see if he agrees with that, what happens there. You know, he's such a versatile tool in the offense. I hope that he's around. I think, you know, he's great for the locker room, his leadership, a lot of things, but, you know, they have some other holes to fill still. So, you know, last episode, a couple episodes ago, I talked about sort of my list of offseason hopes for the 49ers, extending Brandon Ayuk, still TBD, tendered the restricted free agent offer to Juwan Jennings as a second rounder. So if someone wanted to sign Juwan Jennings, they have to offer him more than $5 million a year and be willing to give up a second round pick in exchange for him. JJ was a seventh round pick. I'd be surprised if someone, you know, if another team does that. So I think they'll hang on to Juwan Jennings for sure. Haven't done anything in the guard market thus far. Guard's been getting a lot of money. You know, Robert Hunt, Graham Glasgow, you know, the main guys that I talked about, they've gotten a bunch of money. Laken Tomlinson, I think, still out there. So we'll see if he comes back to the 49ers. Azeez Alshire signed with the Texans. So fingers crossed that Dre Greenlaw is healthy, ready to go, and those young linebackers continue to develop. So where the 49ers are left right now, you know, 2 days into free agency, is needing to nail the draft. And the 49ers have done a lot of great drafting, you know, especially mid and late round picks over the years. George Kittle, Fred Warner, Talanoa Hufanga, Brock Purdy, you know, Dre Greenlaw, lots and lots of guys, excellent all-pro, Pro Bowl level players coming from, you know, the third round and after. But in the more recent drafts, like 2022 particularly, the only guy who's really done anything for them from the 2022 draft is Brock Purdy. Some of those guys are on different teams now. you know, have never really played. Drake Jackson has had his moments, but now coming off a knee injury, we'll see with him. So Niners, first time in a couple of years they've had a first round pick. I'm thinking that's a tackle, maybe a guard, you know, someone who can play right away. They did re-sign Colton McKivitz, a one-year, $7 million deal. Colton McKivitz is fine. Like, he's not a bad offensive lineman, especially not $7 million. It's not realistic for fans to think, like, oh, let's sign this star guy and this star guy and this star guy. Like, that's just not how the teams get constructed. Plus, the 49ers already have a lot of stars. So I trust John Lynch. I trust Kyle Shanahan. They've assembled, you know, arguably the best roster in the NFL, a team that has come very, very close to winning the Super Bowl twice and gone to the NFC Championship two other times. So I think that they're going to do a good job, but it's a very important draft. The rest of the NFL free agency thus far, a very active running back market. I think the Saquon signing for the Eagles is going to be great for them and great for him. Austin Eckler, I could see him doing really well in Cliff Kingsbury's offense out there in Washington. And then Derrick Henry going to the Ravens. If I was a Ravens fan, I'd love it, but I'm not, so I don't, because Derrick Henry is a monster. And the Ravens are extremely physical, and of course Derrick Henry would go there, because they just seem to, you know, stockpile badass running backs. One of their badass running backs, though, Gus the Bus, is coming out here to LA to play for the Chargers, and I think he'll thrive in there with Jim Harbaugh. DeAndre Swift to the Bears, you know, should be a solid spot for him. And then Josh Jacobs going to Green Bay. I don't totally understand why, if you already have a guy in Aaron Jones who you know does well in your offense. Yeah, Josh Jacobs is probably a better player than Aaron Jones, but, you know, if he's getting paid twice as much, he's not twice as good. Like, that's sort of a big consideration, like the real consideration for most of NFL free agency, which I'm going to talk about more in a minute, you know, is the value relative to pay. In the quarterback market, Kirk Cousins, big contract, I think 4 years, 160 to Atlanta. That offense is going to be very formidable. Kirk Cousins is a good quarterback. Kirk Cousins is great at making the throw that you're supposed to make within the framework context of the offense. The McVay, Shanahan coaching tree, LaFleur's, Kevin O'Connell, Zach Taylor, you know, and the new Atlanta offensive coordinator are all from that group, and they all love Kirk Cousins. You know, and they do this for a living in jobs that are extremely hard to get. So they're probably right about it. Is he going to make Atlanta win the Super Bowl? No. Is he going to make them win a very bad NFC South? Probably. Baker, you know, his contract on the face seems like really big. If you get into more of the nitty-gritty of it, it's not near as substantial as it seems, but he did really well for them. He was the number one overall pick. They didn't make him the number one overall pick, you know, in Cleveland because he's not talented. He's not getting paid like other guys who have been number one picks, like Joe Burrow. So is Baker at 33 million as good of a value as like a Joe Burrow at 55 million? Probably not quite, but you know, he was a good quarterback for Tampa Bay last year. I think that'll be a good play for them. On the quarterback side now, though, it becomes a question of like what happens with Justin Fields. His trade market shrinking by the moment. Russ to Pittsburgh, Minshew to Vegas, Sam Darnold to Minnesota. You know, where does Justin Fields fit in now with Kirk going to Atlanta? The most interesting trade spot, and I don't know what value they would get for it, but I think Justin Fields would be a great fit in Indianapolis, because similar style as Anthony Richardson. So, you know, you could have seamless, if Anthony Richardson gets hurt, which Anthony Richardson gets hurt for as big, strong, physical as a guy he is, he got hurt in every game he played last year. And, you know, the transition from Anthony Richardson to then his backup, Justin Fields, would be stylistically, you know, and the way that Shane Steichen wants to call the offense, much smoother transition than Anthony Richardson to Gardner Minshew. And I know Guard's an awesome guy, but he's not Anthony Richardson physically. I think Guard's going to do great in Vegas, and it definitely helps to have Davante Adams there. But Justin Fields, I think, would be a good fit there, as long as it didn't make Anthony Richardson feel like, oh, fuck, you know, Justin Fields is my backup? Like, this feels a little bit too competitive to me. And that's something you got to consider with young quarterbacks. And then the interior lineman side of things, Christian Wilkins, big signing for the Raiders. A lot of guards. Yesterday was a good day to be an offensive guard. Guys getting paid. Robert Hunt, Graham Glasgow, like I mentioned, the Rams signing a couple guards. We'd love for the 49ers to sign a guard, but I think that market's been a little, you know, overheated. We'll see if those signings turn out to be good. Which brings me to my last point about free agency. A lot of those signings are going to turn out not to be good, because most free agent signings, big name ones, aren't good. They don't work out to be, not that the guys aren't good players, but do they play up to the level of their contract? And if you're assembling a great NFL team, you can't pay good players great money, or average players good money, or below average players average money. You need guys to play to the level of their pay or beyond the level of their pay. So I went through the CBS Sports rankings of the top, you know, 100 free agents for 2020, 2021, 2022, and 2023 off seasons, and looked at the top 10 free agents who signed with a different team. So when teams re-sign their own big name free agents, that's a good decision, typically. Doesn't work out all the time, but typically that's a good decision. But it's teams who are going and trying to get someone from another team and say, even though there's a reason that team's getting rid of him, we're going to make it work, or he's going to be just as good or even better for us after we give him all this money, and he could potentially, you know, kind of coast or rest on his laurels. So as I went through these 40 free agents, I ranked them into 5 categories. A great signing, a player who played up to the level that you expected, you know, at or above the level of his contract and had great success. A good signing, you know, played commensurate to the pay, you know, maybe made a Pro Bowl, but someone who is paid appropriately for their performance. A fair signing. Solid player. The way that some of these free agent contracts and the way that I present them here are what the contract is on the face. So, you know, maybe a guy gets signed for like a 3-year, $30 million, and he has 2 good years and they cut him after that. But the third year of his contract, you know, probably wasn't any guaranteed money on it. So it wasn't really like a 3-year contract and wasn't a hit. I gave them a fair rating. Then guys who played, you know, below the level of their contract, or maybe had 1 good year in a 3-year contract and then a, you know, an injury plagued year and got cut or traded or something, I gave them a bad rating. And then finally the bottom was a disaster rating. Someone who got a big contract, you know, maybe 5 years, $70 million, and they played for, you know, 2 shitty years and then got released or traded. So I went through 40 of those. In that, I rated 2 as great. Some of these I gave 2 ratings, like fair good, fair bad. So 9 good contracts, 11.5 fair contracts. So if it was fair/good, we gave half a point to fair and half a point to good. 11.5 fair, 8 bad, and 8.5 disaster. So let's go through some of these. 2020, Tom Brady, 2 years, $50 million. How do you think that worked out? Well, he was Tom Brady and they won the Super Bowl. So great. Started off with a great one. Philip Rivers, 1 year, $25 million. You know, he had at or slightly above his average season. If that would have been a two-year, $50 million contract, yeah, then it would have been probably bad. But I'd say in 2020, a guy getting paid $25 million, that Phillip Rivers was the quality of a $25 million contract. Chris Harris, Jameis Winston. Jameis, you know, people are probably thinking, oh, a terrible signing, but I'm looking just at that contract. 1 year, $1.1 million, a veteran minimum contract. So, you know, they ended up re-signing him two more times for three more years. So he played for the Saints for four total years, and that started off with 1 year, $1 million. So I'd say fair to good. Now, let's get into some of the bad ones. Byron Jones, who became one of the highest paid corners in the NFL, going from Dallas to Miami for 5 years, $82.5 million. Talked about Byron Jones a couple weeks ago on our best combine performances because he had freakish vertical and broad jumps. But he gets a bad rating here. On that 5 year, $82.5 million contract, he played 30 games in his first 2 years, pretty solid seasons, and then was on the physically unable to perform list the whole third year. Then he was kind of cut and retired and pissed at the Dolphins, saying, you know, basically they messed my body up, which is unfortunate. But two solid years on a 5 year, $82.5 million contract does not make a good free agent signing. Corey Littleton, Teddy Bridgewater, Teddy Two Gloves, 3 years, $63 million to Carolina. Played for them for 1 year, 4-11. Traded to the Broncos for a sixth round pick. At least they traded him, so I'm not sure how that trade went. You know, if the Broncos were paying more of his contract then, or the Panthers. Knowing the Panthers, they probably screwed it up, so I should probably just change that one to bad. Besides Tom Brady, likely the best signing in there, Jack Conklin, going from Tennessee to Cleveland. 2020, he was an all-pro. He's had a bunch of injury problems, but the Browns did sign him to a four-year, $60 million extension. Moving on to 2021, we start out with disaster. Kenny Golladay going from Detroit to the Giants, 4 years, $72 million. 43 catches for 602 yards and one touchdown in two seasons. Then released after the 2023 season. Up there with, you know, worst free agent signings you could have. Joe Tooney, one of our two great free agent signings, all pro and two Super Bowls. You know, tough to be better than that. Having some injury problems. Then a couple tight end signings. This was a free agent spending spree for the New England Patriots as they signed some wide receivers this year too. One good tight end signing in Hunter Henry, one bad tight end signing in Jonnu Smith, who they then traded to the Falcons, and then he was cut by the Falcons and now has been signed by the Dolphins. Corey Linsley, two really good years, then some non-football injury IR. You know, he probably would have been good, but if it wasn't for the health stuff, marking him down to fair. Disaster in Carl Lawson, signing for the Jets, tore his ACL right away, missed the whole first year, and then had seven sacks in his second year and none in his third year. So seven sacks in that three-year, $45 million contract, not too good. Moving on to 2022, these guys, some of them a bit harder to evaluate because it's such a short time. But Teron Armstead paid him a ton of money in Miami, made the Pro Bowl in 2022 on just 13 starts, made only 10 starts this year. You know, right now I'd say he's fair because of the Pro Bowl season, but trending towards bad because of the lack of availability. Maybe this upcoming season he trends back towards good. Von Miller, got him there as a disaster. Now, his six-year $120 million contract is not really a six-year $120 million contract. I didn't take the time, you know, I did enough nerding out on the details of this without getting into too many specifics of Von Miller's contract, but eight sacks in 2022, he's only started 11 games in 2 years, a torn ACL, no sacks in 2023, and a warrant out for his arrest. So we're putting that in the bad, probably disaster category. Only bad, maybe if, you know, there was a ton of non-guaranteed money and not dead cap hits. Then another disaster, J.C. Jackson going to the Chargers, 5 years, $82.5 million. They got seven starts out of that in 1.5 seasons, then traded him back to New England with a seventh-round pick for a sixth-round pick. Chandler Jones, disaster, 4.5 seasons, or 4.5 sacks in 2022, and then zero snaps in 2023, all kinds of drama, released. Man, 2022 free agent class, Allen Robinson, disaster, going from Chicago to the Rams. Randy Gregory, disaster, going from Dallas to Denver. And, you know, some of that's injuries and then suspensions. Then he ended up getting traded to the 49ers. But, you know, you sign a guy 5 years for $70 million, and he gives you 12 tackles and two sacks 1 year and plays four games the next year before you trade him. Sounds like a disaster. Christian Kirk, an interesting one here. If you would have asked me right after this happened, I would have thought Christian Kirk wildly overpaid at 4 years, $72 million, kind of kicked off a wide receiver spending spree across the league that offseason, but he would have proved me wrong there. 84 catches for 1,108 yards and 8 touchdowns in 2022. Some injuries in 2023, but he's being very productive when he's healthy. And now looking at some wide receiver contracts, 4 for $72 million isn't terrible. So fair to good, especially if he can stay healthy and productive this next year. And the 2023 class, very little to go off here, but you can take a look at that. Derek Carr, fair to bad. I mean, Derek Carr pretty much had a Derek Carr season last year. Javon Hargrave for the 49ers, not yet living up to the level that they had hoped. 7 sacks, had a sack in the Super Bowl. He's doing some good things. But this year, with Armstead being gone, Kinlaw being gone, Javon Hargrave going to need to really step up for the 49ers this year and prove that he was deserving of that 4-year, $84 million contract. Going down the list, Orlando Brown, fair, not too highly paid, the worst PFF grade since his rookie year, but you're getting a starting tackle there, you know, better than average starting tackle. Juwan Taylor, tough to say that that's not a good signing. You know, he's not a great tackle. He gets a lot of penalties called on him, but, well, you won a Super Bowl with him, so that's pretty good. Then Tremaine Edmonds, fair to good. He's now the third highest paid inside linebacker. Probably overpaying him. A very Chicago thing to do would be to overpay a linebacker. But a very, very good player. Not to the Fred Warner level. Not to the Roquan Smith level. Not in that conversation, but gets paid like him. That's why I gave him fair to good. Mike McGlinchey, a guy that I really like personally, but a really bad signing, and I knew it when it happened. Very good run blocker, very average pass blocker, very overpaid in Denver. 5 years, $87.5 million. His replacement for the 49ers, Colt McKivitz, was graded higher than him in pass protection this past season and did that for about a quarter of the price. So as you get excited about your team's free agent signings or mad that they didn't sign someone, you know, more prominent, think of this. Of these 40 players that I graded here, we had 11 of the 40, just over 25%, as a good or great signing. 16.5, bad or a disaster, and 11.5, fair. So the chances that you got a good or great signing are like, 25, 30%. Of these top free agents, the biggest name guys turn out to be good. Is that they're a little bit older? Is that they get complacent and aren't working as hard once they get paid? Is it scheme fit? So many possibilities, but we could go back and do this exercise for more and more and more years and you'd see the same trends. Signing big name free agents is rarely what leads a team to being a great football team. Signing big-name free agents from other teams, re-signing your own great players, definitely. You want your team to do that. But if you pay good players great money or average players good money, that's where you get in trouble. That's where I think a team like the Cowboys is going to be in trouble if they pay Dak 5 years, $300 million, and the way that they paid Zeke, even though they're paying their own guys like that. So yeah, be mindful of that. Be cautious. You know, it's kind of like the investing saying, you know, to be greedy when others are fearful and fearful when others are greedy. NFL free agencies kind of like that as well. So thank you for, you know, sitting through me for some personal therapy session and hearing my ramblings about all this stuff. Please subscribe, rate, and review. Hopefully you enjoyed it. Cheers to all you fine folks out there.